Folks, it's a Thursday, and it's that time we take a peek and get our view from the north. Feel like it's been kind of a full week. You can find our guests' work for NBC Sports Northwest online, nbcsports.com/northwest. Talking Ducks with Newman, Kent, and Harrington each week. Channel 737 on your Xfinity system. Follow on Twitter at Aaron J. Fentress. Mr. Fentress, how you doing?
What is up, my man?
A lot, although now a little anticlimactic. One thing I always love about the playoffs, be it NBA or MLB, all week long, big games. So for me, it's like, I'm not saying there's not a lot happening, but I really love that on a Tuesday night, you can get a legendary game that kind of takes a step towards crowning a champ, you know what I mean?
Yeah, when the baseball postseason is on point, there is that sense of withdrawal when it ends.
Yeah.
I mean, baseball regular season is just, you know,
forever.
Fast forward. Like I record Cubs games. I watch them in 20 minutes. I just fast forward. So I see like up on the little bases box, if I see a person has advanced or a score change, then I'll watch. But playoff baseball, you're like hanging on every pitch. You know, it's like 2-2, and you're like, oh my God, what's going to happen next?
Yeah.
It's fun.
And then, of course, for selfish reasons for this year, I mean, you got a Cubs title last year, back to the Final Four this year as a Yankee fan. So for selfish reasons, it's been equally fun as well.
Yeah, no doubt.
All right. I got to get into something you tweeted about. The first time I did my show, we're going to late 93, early 94. The first time the phones lit up, Nancy and Tonya. And now we get the flick, I, Tonya. Great cast, huge Portland connection. 24 years later, good level of interest in this still?
Oh, I think so. It's one of the greatest sports stories ever. I don't think it's going to break the bank at the box office, but I think there's definitely going to be intrigue and interest in the story. And it looks like they've done a really good artsy job with it. Like, it looks like they didn't just do some, you know, basic run-of-the-mill movie. It looks like they tried to do a really interesting take on it. And it's one of those stories that just you don't, like, if it just came out on its own and it never really happened in real life, you'd be like, whatever.
<You know? laughs> Yeah.
But because all the characters, I mean, from Galooly to Eckhart to all these clowns she was with, it's just, you know, in a lot of ways for me, Tonya's a tragic figure. I mean, she grew up with not the greatest mom in the world, very poor, low self-esteem. I mean, I just wish, like, someone back when she was 15, someone with means, someone who took a true interest in her would have just swooped in and just helped her. You know, just helped her in every way imaginable that she wasn't getting from her home life. Helped her stay away from a clown like Galooly, who basically just latched on to her because he saw her as a money train. So for all the things she's done wrong in her life, I really still view her as a very sympathetic character, because she had it rough.
Yeah, I have a feeling if she's out there, LaVonda Golden, her mom, probably not going to be thrilled with this portrayal from what I'm reading.
And even every documentary about her, I mean, she's never been painted in a good light, and she definitely had issues. And who knows, she probably grew up in a very, you know, poor way as well. So it's kind of a sad story.
All right. And by the way, the fact that it's almost 25 years later, wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I had just started at the Oregonian, and I was a GA reporter as an intern, and so I got caught up in the whole mess with that, and I had to, like, stake out the courthouse looking for her or any of the other defendants, and I had to stake out the Clackamas Town Center in case she might show up skating. I spent, like, 15 hours overnight staking out her house. No, her dad's house.
Wow.
Yeah, I was a photographer. They rotated the photographer I was with, but they didn't rotate the intern. I stayed there all night waiting for someone to come home. And her dad actually came home. I remember we followed her dad down this dark road to her to the house in these cars, and I was like spooked out. I was like, what if they whack my knee? And she just told the photographer. Tom Trike was a photographer. He had shot Tonya forever, so he knew the family. And he went up and talked to the dad, and dad's like, "Yeah, she's not here. She's not coming back tonight." But we still stayed there till like morning, and I finally got relieved.
Wow, great connection. I got to share one story. So I was at the ESPN 25th anniversary party in 2004, and I had a couple glasses of wine, and Nancy Kerrigan walks in, and I'm with my wife, and I gave her like, hey, how you doing, Nancy? And she totally snubbed me. So about 15 minutes later, I said to my wife, I should go up to her and say, hey, I'm from Oregon. I'll get the old group together. You better watch yourself, kid.
Yeah, that would have gone over well.
Yeah, that would have been the quickest stay at the ESPN zone in Times Square ever. Oh, man. All right, talking with Aaron Fentress of NBC Sports Northwest. I guess we got to get to Oregon football. The one thing I love, social media feeds the insanity. So Jim McElwain gets fired, and I love the fact in your three and out you made the duh connection. He's from Florida. He coached in South Florida. So obviously Willie Taggart's heading back. But I thought he handled it great. Well, what did he have to say about that this week?
Yeah, I mean, he dismissed it, obviously, said that he's not going anywhere, he's committed to Oregon, he's only worried about Washington, he told the team that, et cetera, et cetera. But let's face it, every coach that's ever left anywhere said those things before they left, right?
Right.
I've been thinking about this for a few days, it's just such a weird thing. So, okay, here's the deal. If Florida calls Willie Taggart's agent or calls Willie Taggart tomorrow and says, we want you 5 years, $20 million, he's gone. I firmly believe that he's out. And I think it only makes sense. He's from Florida. His mom, Gloria, lives in Florida. His father just passed away over the summer. Wouldn't he want to work and be closer to his mom, who's now 3,200 miles away? His whole family lives down in Florida. Very strong family and extended family down there for him. That's a no-brainer. Now, if, you know, Texas comes open or Tennessee comes open or Penn State or something like that, you know, maybe he doesn't just bolt just for that. Not that those aren't, you know, maybe bigger destination programs in Oregon. Well, no, they are. But, you know, I think the Florida connection is something that will be hard for him to turn down, even if it's Florida State or Miami. The question is Florida after him? And I think that's where the reach is. I don't understand why it's automatically believed that Florida is after Taggart after not even a full season at a Power 5 conference. Remember, he had never, the first Power 5 conference job he's ever been offered was Oregon, and he was Oregon's fifth choice.
Sure.
Now, whether that's right or wrong, that's what he was. And, you know, it's not necessarily wrong. He was finally getting his footing in at South Florida. I think they went 8-5 in 2015. They were kicking butt last year. So he had one really, really good season under his belt. Even at Western Kentucky, his best season was 7-5. So it's not like he was dominating. He was clearly rebuilding and doing well in an up-and-coming coach that looks like he might be a future superstar coach. But the idea that he would just be at the top of Florida's list simply because he's from Florida doesn't make any sense to me. And then people say, oh, recruiting. Well, Florida recruits itself. You need Willie Taggart to recruit Florida? Right? If you're Oregon, you need Willie Taggart to recruit Florida.
Right.
If you're Florida, do you need Willie Taggart to recruit Florida? Not necessarily. But for him, heck, if I'm him and I'm getting five kids from Florida to come to Oregon, and I now coach Florida, and I only have to recruit within 500 miles of, you know, where I coach. If that, yeah, that's very enticing. So now what I'm hearing is that he's not at the top of their list. I don't know why I keep hearing this. I don't know, and this falls in the same reasons why I would be surprised if Taggart were at the top of the list. And Scott Frost allegedly is at the top of the list.
Yeah.
To me, that doesn't make any sense, because then I say, well, wait a minute. Why is Frost, you know, at the top of the list and not Taggart? Because if you look at the two resumes, it's not close. Taggart crushes them because Taggart's done more. And Taggart whooped his ass last year. So the whole thing is just bizarre to me. My guess is that it's not going to happen this year. But one final thing. Oregon fans, be on red alert every year, because the closer he comes to having success at Oregon, big success by maybe winning the conference or contending for it, the closer he is to being gone. And no matter what he says, if the right job comes open in Florida, he's out.
Yeah, when he got the job and I did research, I said Willie Taggart is a trajectory guy, because
exactly.
He went from a position coach to a coordinator at a lower level. Then he got the gig at Western Kentucky. Then he got the gig in a Power 5, but as a position coach. Then a head coach at an FBS school. Then a head coach at a Power 5 school. So every step he's taken hasn't even been close to lateral. It's been up.
Right, so. Exactly. And the next step up would be a bigger, more marquee program,
sure.
and preferably for him, obviously, in Florida. So the question is when that's going to happen. And that was one of the dangers, and I spoke about this when the whole Helfrich thing was going down. That staff wasn't going anywhere. You knew you had loyalty. They were going to be there. Now, a lot of fans will say, well, we don't want that because we don't think they can win anymore, which I still debate. But the problem is if you don't want to become a stepping stone either.
Of course not. No.
Yeah, and that's the thing. So if Taggart comes in, let's say in 3 years he gets them, they go 11-2, win the conference, and maybe make the playoffs, don't make the playoffs, doesn't matter, and then he's out. So now where are you? Now you're going to try and replace him with someone else. Well, who are you going to get? Because you just saw how hard it was to get, you know, who you wanted last time. You didn't. You settled on Taggart, really. Now, I think it was a great – now, for me, I thought Taggart was the right choice over all the other guys that I'm looking at. Like, why go with the older coach who's been around the block and hasn't achieved even more than what your previous coach achieved going to the playoffs? Why not go with a young and up-and-coming guy? But the danger in that, obviously, is that he's going to use you as a stepping stone. And if you're Oregon, you think you're a destination program and someone's stepping on your head to get to another job – that's going to be a bad look.
We're talking Duck football with Aaron Fentress, NBC Sports Northwest. You brought up an interesting angle. Mario Cristobal was at Alabama last year, and they faced this Washington defense and did a pretty good job against them. So despite what they lost in the secondary to the NFL draft, they just lost their corner, Jordan Miller. What's Cristobal been saying, and I guess what's the word about how strong this UW defense still is?
Well, Cristobal says that he doesn't see much of a drop-off at all from – last year, and that's scary because they were pretty good last year. But at the same time, when he was at Alabama, they handled him pretty well last year in the playoffs. And you know, he talked about how there's still stuff in the middle. They like to just stuff up the middle and force you outside, and then let their linebackers clean up everything. And they do a great job of it. They're only giving up 77 yards, which really is phenomenal, especially in this conference. We have a lot of good offenses who can run the football.
Yep.
They haven't played a lot of the top rushing offenses. Most of the teams they've played are in the bottom third of the conference. So obviously Oregon will be a new challenge for them. But at the same time, you know, Oregon could be coming into this game one-dimensional. If they're one-dimensional, then it's going to be very tough for me to imagine them moving the ball against a team as stout as Washington's defense.
I want to hit rewind. That Utah game, and you told us last week how the coaches and players watched that UCLA film together to kind of get a gauge, each unit mistakes and the impact it made team-wide, and not using the absence of Herbert as an excuse. So I guess how important was that, as you wrote, that they accepted the culpability in beating the Utes?
Well, it sounds like it was huge, and I think the proof was on the field against Utah because they looked like a completely different team all over the place. And, you know, Tiger's point was, you know, got to rally around your quarterback, man. You can't blame the quarterback. Everyone can't put it on him. And I think for me what it showed was that, okay, before when we had Herbert was so good that it elevated everything and he could mask mistakes, he can make up for things, et cetera, et cetera. But now we don't have that. Everyone else has to pick up, you know, the slack on their end. They can't commit the same errors. They can't commit the same penalties. They can't make the same mistakes that the team got away with by having Herbert at quarterback. And it looks like they all recognize it. And I thought it was genius of him to have the entire team watch the entire film together because, you know, it's good for guys to see other people's mistakes and know what they've done on the other side of the ball, not just on their side of the ball. And one, you can hold people accountable. You can hold each other accountable that way. And then plus you can see how it all fits together, how, yeah, you know what, missing the block there, if he'd made that block, that could have been a 15-yard gain instead of a 2-yard loss, and now we're punting. And now on defense, we're getting the ball, you know, on defense, we're on the field with the other team taking over at midfield. When had that one guy made that block, we would have got him 15 yards. I mean, even if we didn't get their first down, better field position, the mistakes. And then the guys on offense are seeing, well, yeah, the guy on defense, and they sort of see, man, you know what? We're all screwing up. we're all accountable for this. It's not just Burmeister didn't complete the big pass. You know, there's other things you can do in a game to prevent and or make it more likely that you make a big play. And so they bought into that. But Utah's not Washington, because Washington's going to force you into making a whole different set of mistakes.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, I appreciate
now, they are struggling on offense, though. I mean, their passing game, they lost their tight end. They lost one of the receivers. Browning hasn't looked as good, but their running game is still pretty devastating.
No, we were talking with Adam Jude earlier, and he said beyond Pettis, I mean, they don't get any consistency from anybody catching the ball. So
right.
We
neither does Oregon.
Yeah. But we didn't. We kind of expected that. But anyway,
right.
Fun stuff as always. We move into November. You travel safe to the what I call the land of Satan, Seattle. And
wow,
that has to. Yeah. By the way, that goes back to Edgar Martinez driving in Ken Griffey Jr. to beat the Yankees in '95. Still haven't recovered from that.
But I was at game four of that series when they brought in Randy Johnson to close it.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
I was at that game. That was pretty epic.
Yeah, I'm still a little nauseous over it. Hey, good stuff as always, my friend. Travel safe. We'll catch up next week.
Okay, bye.
Take it easy.